come up on a tight wire.
I'm in the arena sitting across from an empty chair because my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines couldn't be with us this week. He's off doing a reading somewhere at some college somewhere, so I'm doing the show alone today, and I am Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. We have a very exciting show for you today. We have Denise DeHummel. This is the second time she's been on our show because she just came out with a new book of poems called Blowout, and it is a collection put out by the Pitts Poetry Series, which, you know, as you know, is one of the best publishers of poetry in the country. And I'm very excited to talk about this new book, Blowout. And on Poetic License today, I am going to talk a little bit about divorce. And the reason why I'm going to talk about it is because Denise DeHummel's book has a lot to do with a recent divorce. And I just went through a divorce, so I thought I would say a few words about that. So stick around. It's going to be a great show. But first, I want to tell you what I did last night. Last night, when I should have been reading my student's theses and doing a bunch of other stuff, like taking my dog for a walk, instead, I got a cheeseburger. I didn't get fries. I had it with an apple because I'm trying to at least be partially healthy. I got a cheeseburger, and I rented a movie from Redbox. It's called Searching for Sugarman. And I don't know if you've heard of this movie, but it is a beautiful, touching work of art. I wept several times watching it, but I'm very sentimental and I weep quite a bit. But it's about this musician out of Detroit named Rodriguez. He did a couple of albums in the 70s, and they were critically acclaimed. He was compared to Bob Dylan. In fact, many of the critics said he went beyond Bob Dylan, that his songs were so original. It was poetry. And really, he wrote these really beautiful, beautiful songs. And the record companies were very excited, but nothing sold. He sold no records in the U.S. When interviewer in this documentary called Searching for Sugarman asked the company record executive how much he sold, he said maybe six. It was an incredible failure, and nobody could understand why. And if you think about it, here's this guy named Rodriguez in the 70s, and one of the record producers kind of hit on it, I think. He said, I think people might have thought it was ethnic with that name, Rodriguez. And people back then weren't into ethnic music. And it made me think that the rejection of Rodriguez by the culture might very well have done with the fact that they expected him to be doing cultural music. And there were no bongos, and there was no arriba, arriba, and there was no merengue, and there was nothing that tied this Chicano boy from Detroit to Mexican heritage, and there was no way you were going to listen to his music and say, I learned something about being Mexican. He didn't write about being Mexican. He just wrote about Detroit. He wrote about the streets. He wrote about the people. He wrote about depression. He wrote about poverty. He wrote about workers' rights. And I don't think people really wanted to hear that from a Mexican. I think racism had a lot to do with it. But one of the ironic things is his record somehow got shipped to South Africa, and he became a big legend there. They loved him. He was a bestseller. His record sold 500,000 copies in a very small country. And here's the ironic thing. They sold to middle-class white South Africans who were just barely beginning to learn how to speak against apartheid, one of the most blatant racist laws put up by a white government against blacks. And Rodriguez's words and his songs taught them to speak out against apartheid. What a beautiful irony, isn't it? That this young Chicano guy from Detroit was rejected here, probably because of race, and his music made its way to South Africa, and he was in part responsible for the shifting of consciousness from middle-class white people about apartheid and about racism and about resistance. And it's just a beautiful story. And of course, it's more complex. That's only one aspect of it. And it's really an interesting story. I highly recommend it. It's called Searching for Sugarman. It touched me. So stick around, and we are going to talk to Denise DeHummel, author of the new collection of poems, Blowout.
Sugarman, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams.
Denise Duhamel is professor of English at Florida International University and the author of numerous poetry collections, including Ka-Ching, Two and Two, and A Queen for a Day, Selected and New Poems. Duhamel has written 5 chapbooks of poetry and co-edited with Maureen Seaton and David Trinidad, Saints of Hysteria, A Half Century of Collaborative American Poetry. The recipient of numerous awards, including an NEA fellowship, she has been anthologized widely. Duhamel is a guest editor for Best American Poetry of 2013. Welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And this is your second appearance because the first book, Ka-Ching, the first Denise Duhamel book that I fell in love with, we talked about November, I think it was.
I think it was October, yes, in 2012.
Yeah, and your new book just came out. It's called Blowout, and it's also part of the Pitts Poetry Series. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, where are you today? Are you in you're in Florida?
I'm in Florida today, yes. I'm home.
And you teach at Florida International University. You teach poetry, creative writing there, yes?
Yes, I do.
But I'm holding in my hand a copy of Blowout, your latest book, and Blowout blew me away. It's a beautiful book. It touches on a lot of themes, but it seems to be centered on this relationship gone bad, on a divorce. And the book starts with a poem called How It Will End, which I think is an apt title not only for the poem itself, but for the theme of the book, because this marriage is about to end on this poem. We see a couple, and they're observing another couple on the beach, and the couple is fighting. And the way they interpret the fight, you know, we understand immediately is essentially they're talking about themselves, and they're talking about their own marriage. But what I love about the poem is when the language works both on the observed and the observer at once, like the line that goes, "My husband says he's doing the best he can." He's talking about himself in that line, but the next line goes on to say that he's a lifeguard, for Christ's sake, and suddenly the line goes back to the observed. And I love how that works on both levels, because it makes the entire landscape really about something else. Was this a difficult book to write?
Yes. Yeah, it was, actually. I mean, it wasn't difficult to write, but it was difficult to order and then decide to publish. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, I could have just skipped this book completely. You know what I mean? The way you want to skip these things in your life. But I also felt like I had written so much about relationships before. Mm-hmm. And I think writing the poems were not as difficult as one might think. I mean, I think it was really actually helpful to write the poems. But then, like, looking at them over time is difficult. And trying to see, like, is there even a book here? And, I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, How It Will End, I wrote way before I even knew. It was so, sometimes I think poems, for me, say more than I even know.
Right.
Like, if you would have said, like, this poem, I think, first appeared in maybe 2006, so I probably wrote it around then, and if you would have said, oh, this poem's about the end of the marriage, I was like, oh, no, it's a silly fight. I really had no idea, so I think, I know poetry isn't therapy, and you're not supposed to say that, but I think in my case, this really was actually very therapeutic in a strange way.
Right.
To write these poems, like the poems knew something was wrong before I knew something was wrong.
Yeah, that does happen when you go back on something you've written before, and you go, my God, how did I know that and not know that I knew it?
I knew it, but I wouldn't let myself know it, maybe. I guess that's how it goes.
You know, I recently went through a divorce, very, very recently, and it was.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was difficult, but one of the ways that I dealt with the pain, the variety of emotions that comes with it, was to write poems. I'm a fiction writer, but suddenly I started writing poems.
But makes sense.
I see that the more distance from the divorce, the more the poems seemed to shift. For example, the first ones might be, for me, were full of a lot of anger. But then after a while, you know, it seems as if somehow we're following these stages of grief, I guess you could say.
Yes, right.
And we end up with acceptance, and we end up with a really peaceful and beautiful somehow conclusion to all the sadness. And your book seems to do that. I love the last poem. It's called Ode to Your Eyebrows.
Yeah.
the penultimate poem, of course, I think leads perfectly into that poem. The penultimate poem is called Having a Diet Coke with You. Was this conscious to make it such a positive ending?
Yes, it was. I mean, it was almost like, how am I going to get out of this in the history? You know what I mean? Like, if you write about death, for example, and then divorce is sort of like a death, like, there has to be a rebirth. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but, I mean, it was either let go at the end or, I mean, there had to be something, right?
Right.
And in my case, I was just lucky enough that I found, you know, I had a new person to write about. But then it's like this new person, it's sort of like you go in with all the, like, you can't be naive anymore. You know what I mean? Like, you just have to go in, like, going, well, something's going to go wrong, but I'm still going to do it. You know, that sort of attitude, I guess.
In the poem that you write about having a Diet Coke with you, you write that love poems are more difficult poems to write because each love poem contains its opposite, its loss.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
no matter how fierce the love of that couple, and this is an exact quote, one of them will leave the other, if not through betrayal, then through death. Yet at the same time, the speaker of the poem makes the choice to go ahead and take the plunge again.
Right. That you do have a choice. The choice is, you know, be alone,
right?
Which is an okay choice too. Which is like a fine choice actually. But yeah, to go in with your eyes wide open is such a strange. When you first get divorced, you think, forget it. Like, I will never, ever, ever even like say hi to anybody again. You know what I mean?
Right.
You feel really, or I did anyway. I felt so protective, and so scared. And then somehow, like, that healing happens. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and what makes the ending of this poem, of this book, so beautiful and so as if the speaker has moved on, and not as
mm-hmm.
if the speaker is hiding the pain, you know, and jumping into another relationship, but has actually moved on. But what makes that so believable and so triumphant is the poems that deal earlier in the book with men trying to pick her up,
and her resistance
of that. Yeah, because, you know, she's not ready yet.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's my friends and I have so many friends who are divorced, and the women would say, like someone going through a divorce gives off these, like, needy pheromones. You know? Even though you're a complete mess, there's always some guy going, you know, like that, oh, maybe I can get some whatever, you know what I mean? Like, get a date, because there's something so, like, wrecked about people when they're actually going, I mean, it's just so painful, right? And
right.
I guess that is so apparent.
Yeah, I wonder if that's different for men than for women, because, like, with women, I think men might say, oh, there's a vulnerable spot.
Yes.
You know, but with women, I'm not sure that same quality would attract them in a man.
Right, unless it's, like, I think for women, this is very, like, stereotypical, and I'm sure there's all kinds of, on the spectrum, that people behave differently. But, like, for women, I've seen women go, like, oh, I can save, oh, the poor thing, and they try to save them. You know what I mean? Maybe that's more the, and maybe men do that, too, in a strange way. Men are trying to rescue this person that seems pretty broken.
We had Natalie Goldberg on the show the other day, and
she came out
with a new book, and a lot of her concept of writing is that it's therapeutic, which is something I've always resisted. You know, I tell my students, if you're writing for purposes of therapy, well, you know, go home and write. And what are you doing in an MFA program?
Yes.
But on the other hand, you know, having gone through, you know, a divorce and having lost my father, you know, right before the divorce.
It's exactly what happened to me.
That's weird. That happens a lot.
Yeah. It does happen a lot.
You lose a parent and the divorce follows. That's a strange phenomenon. And I don't think it's consciously done, but it's, you know, I don't know, maybe one death allows the death of another. Who knows?
Yes. Oh, it's fascinating.
But although I've resisted this idea of therapy and writing, when you're a writer, you know, you have to do something with that pain. And the fact is, one of my colleagues, well, you know, Ben, the guy I do the show with, he told me, he says, if it doesn't hurt, it's probably not going to be worth much. And
that's very interesting.
Yeah, and although I'm not sure that I entirely think that's true for everything I've written, you know, I think allowing it to hurt and allowing yourself to to express that anger and that denial and all those stages of grief in a poem, you know, it makes for beautiful poetry, but it actually helps. It's therapeutic.
It actually does. It actually does because it's in front of you. I mean, especially if you write and then let time go by and you return to the poem, I mean, it kind of like slays the monster in a way because the monster is kind of in front of you on the page and suddenly you're like, oh, this line break's no good or... Oh, this is really sentimental. And, I mean, it helps you to revise more freely or something. I don't know. If you wait and write it 3 years later and you're already past the situation, that's what everyone says to do, right?
Right, absolutely.
Emotion, recollected, and tranquility. Like, but there's something lost when you're tranquil. I don't know. There's something...
Right, but the key that you just brought up, you said, is, you know, after letting it sit for a while, you return to it. As opposed to the student who wrote the love poem and handed you a love poem and said, you know, and it was sentimental and sappy because she was going through a relationship at that point that she really thought was, you know, the end all. But give it some distance in the revisions. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's something about immediately writing it down, immediately letting that pain come out that gives it its own rhythm and it takes over its own. There's a spirit about it. There's something about it that goes beyond you. This book is about, you know, divorce, and it's about relationships, but really it goes way beyond that. I think it's a book for women. It's a book that stands up for women. It's a book that speaks for many, many women in relationships, and it's very empowering. This book needed to be written. This book needed to be said. And lest we give people the wrong impression, it's also a very funny book. There's a lot of humor. I love that poem called My Strip Club.
Right.
And it's like what a woman would want to see in a strip club if women were stripping. And can you read that? Do you have your book in front of you? Because I wanted to
read
it aloud, but I thought, you know what? Maybe Denise would be willing to read it.
Okay. So this is a little, like for me, it's a pretty short poem. My Strip Club. In my strip club, the girls crawl on stage wearing overalls and turtlenecks, then slowly pull on gloves, ski masks, and hiking boots. As the music slows, they lick the pole, and for a tantalizing second, their tongues stick because it's so cold. They zip up parkas and tie tight bows under their hoods. A big spender can take one of my girls into a back room where he can clamp on her snowshoes.
I love that poem. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And I love your version of the VIP dance, right?
Like he has to dress, the customer has to actually put more clothes on her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's amazing the natural form that we have inside of us, and we don't even realize it until we're printing the poems out and putting them all on the floor and looking at the... Do you do that? Do you print out your poems and put them on the floor? And
Oh, yeah. And to put a book together is... I mean, I would rather write 500 poems than put a book together. For me, that's so hard to do.
Oh.
And I mean, I just resist it. I don't want to do it because I never think, I always forget that I've already done it, and that's fine, and I can do it. But the idea of it is, it's very difficult. But I have a really good friend, Stephanie Strickland, who's another poet, and she and I help each other to put our books together. Because sometimes we see things that the other doesn't see.
Right.
You know, like, oh, you've used the word sparrow 85 times. It's a little much or whatever. Because I do think our obsession, you know, for me, it was because I live in Florida, you know, the lifeguard hut, the beach. They just keep reoccurring, you know, our locale or whatever it is.
You know, I would think that would be one of the most pleasurable parts of putting a book together is printing them out and putting them on the floor, the pages. Because you can't do that when you're writing a novel.
That is true. You got to just put one foot in front of the other, huh?
Before we go, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the anthology that you're editing, The Best American Poetry of 2013, which is published every year by Scribner and is certainly one of the most important, I think, poetry anthologies series that comes out. And you're the editor this time, and you have people in there that are fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about being the editor of that series?
Well, it was an amazing experience, as you can imagine. It was a lot of reading. I feel like I know almost every, I feel like I know almost every poet in the country, which I know is impossible, but boxes of magazines would just come week after week after week. And it was really fun and very, very difficult to choose. And I really tried to ask, I mean, I begged David to make it 150 poems instead of 75. It was really that difficult.
Wow.
I mean, I know everyone says that, oh, all poems sound the same and poets and this and that, but I found so many really interesting poems.
Who are some of the writers you had to include?
Well, oddly enough, I didn't include them. It's so funny that the ones that... Okay, when I went in, I said to David, I really have to include Sharon Olds and Albert Goldbarth.
Mm.
I love them so much. You know, I feel like they've both been really, big influences. And then they had, hardly any poems this year. So it was really odd. Like, even the people I thought I have to include weren't there. So it was just very odd. I mean, it's very, very odd. So I included a lot of newcomers that haven't been in before. So I was really happy about that. Because I know when I was first starting out, I was in Best Direct Poetry in 1993, and that was the same year my first book came out by a tiny, bitty press that's, not even in business anymore. And it was so important to me. So, there's this guy in there. His name is Nathan Anderson, and he wrote this really good poem called Stupid Sandwich. I was like, this has to be, it's just hilarious. It's the first time there's a collaboration in the anthology, so that was really cool. And it's by two people I'd never read before. Their names are Angela Veronica Wong and Amy Lawless. It was funny because I really thought, okay, this person has to be in, this person has to be in, and then it didn't happen. So it was a very strange and wonderful experience.
It's a great series. I can't wait to look at it. I am on Facebook, and two of my Facebook friends, Paisley Redcall and Daisy Free, both posted when they found out that you included them, and they were very grateful.
Oh, I'm so glad. I am so glad. Paisley's poem is amazing, as is Daisy's. I mean, really,
yeah, they're
really
incredible
strong.
Poets.
Yeah, they really are. They really, really are.
Thank you again. The book is lovely.
It was so great to talk to you.
The book is called Blowout, and it's by Denise DeHommel, brand new. Please check it out. It's a great book. Denise, thank you so much for joining us in Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you. It's been a blast.
In the spirit of today's show, I'm going to do a poetic license on my recent divorce. And I really couldn't think of a title any more original than Divorce is Difficult. So here is my poetic license. Divorce is difficult. I know some people have had worse divorces than mine. Divorces with children, divorces with many possessions to fight over, divorces with betrayal, hatred, and many, many horrible, horrible things. My divorce was pretty easy. One day my wife informed me she didn't want to be married to me anymore, and we parted ways. I didn't fight for our marriage for two reasons. One, she didn't want me to fight for our marriage. She didn't want me to hang on to try to make it work. She was ready to move on. The second reason is because I respected her desire to move on. She's young, brilliant, deserving of whatever she wants in life, and always knew that should she need to move on, it would be patriarchal and oppressive and very selfish to stand in her way. So we said goodbye. She has her job, a job she does very well, a job that she deeply deserves to hold. And I have my job, a job I deeply love, one that I cannot imagine trading in for anything else. We both teach creative writing in an MFA. No comp, no survey lit courses, just creative writing, what we love. So we each have our dream jobs, and we had a house and two dogs, and we traveled the world. When we broke up, I took my airline miles, and she took hers. She took one dog, the dog that she picked out, the one she named Sonnet after the poetic form, she a poet, and I took the other dog, Kafka, a dog that I chose from the shelter and whom I named, me, a fiction writer. It was difficult. Even though it was so easy, even though with mutual respect we parted ways, it was difficult. It happened right before Thanksgiving, and I remember going to the same Albertsons where we shopped together for years. I purchased a roasted turkey leg already prepared and cold mashed potatoes you warm up in the microwave. I wept over that meal, my tears falling into the brown gravy like oil into water. I looked up the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, five of them, anger, depression, bargaining, denial, and acceptance. And I witnessed myself experience each of them, sometimes all of them in one day and in different order. Grief is not linear. No matter how much mutual respect we have for each other, no matter how clean the break, I was in love, and to lose a loved one leads to these stages. I would say that we were in love, but I will let her speak for herself. I was in love. She was my family. I suddenly found myself without a family. I'm currently living in a one-bedroom apartment with a balcony overlooking Ciudad Juarez, where sometimes I stand and stare at the grocery store across the street, Esse Mart, and I watch the little white buses go in and out of the parking lot. I watch the families walk into the sliding glass doors of the grocery store. And even though it's the closest store to my front door, I would need to take my passport if I wanted to shop there and wait in line at the international entry port, the bridge, and it could take me hours. The Albertsons, where we used to shop together, is 3 times as far, but it only takes me 10 minutes to get there. There's something about that closeness, that distance. There's something about being so close yet so far from God, so close to the United States. Frankie Valli singing, so close and yet so far. There's something about being able to see the signs in the windows advertise meat prices and fruits and vegetables, but not being able to go into that store and get a shopping cart and pick out vegetables as if for a lover. It wasn't easy. But the one thing they do not tell you about sadness, the one thing you never hear, is what is most beautiful about it. The Hebrew God says, I form the light and I create darkness. I make peace and I create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. The preacher says, there is a time to weep and a time to laugh. Life is such that you will grieve. You will feel pain. And because it is a fundamental component of God's gift to us, that is, life itself, it is good. Sadness is good. The gift of sadness is peace. Consider a painting, perhaps the one by Dalí, Muchacha en la Ventana, girl standing in the window. She wears a thin blue dress, standing at a window overlooking the sea or a lake, a very famous painting. Take a look at it closely, and you will see her looking out onto the water, and you will sense a deep sadness, which exists simultaneously with a deep feeling of peace. The gift of sadness is peace. Yeah, it was hard, but the peace makes it all right. The peace. Peace be with all divorced couples, and the married ones, too. I'd like to thank our guest, Denise DeHummel, for joining us on this edition of Words on a Wire. Join us next week. Benjamin Alida Sainz will be back with us. There's a song by Rodriguez where he says, hello always ends with goodbye. In the end, love sucks. Because in the end, we're going to lose it. But we do it anyway. Because the only alternative is not to love. And life without love is not worth living. And remember, the next book you read may save your marriage.
The generals hate holidays. Others shoot up to chase the sun blues away. Another storefront church is open. Sea of neon lights. A boxer, his shadow fights. Soldier tired and sailor broken. Night rains tap at my window. Winds of my thoughts passing by. She laughed when I tried to tell her. Hello only ends in goodbye.